नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ग्रंथराज श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 12 चैप्टर 13 टेक्स्ट 15 सर्ववेदांतसारं हि श्रीभागवतम् इष्यते तद्रसामृततृप्तस्य नान्यत्र स्याद्रतिः क्वचित् सर्ववेदांतसारं हि श्रीभागवतम् इष्यते तद्रसामृततृप्तस्य नान्यत्र स्याद्रतिः क्वचित् सर्ववेदांतसारं हि श्रीभागवतम् इष्यते तद्रसामृततृप्तस्य नान्यत्र स्याद्रतिः क्वचित् श्रीभागवतम् इष्यते तद्रसामृततृप्तस्य नान्यत्र स्याद्रति क्वचित् वेदान्तसारं हि श्रीभागवतमिष्यते तद्रसामृततृप्तस्य नान्यत्र स्याद्रति क्वचित् वेदान्तसारं हि श्रीभागवतमिष्यते तद्रसामृततृप्तस्य नान्यत्र स्याद्रति क्वचित् वेदान्तसारं हि श्रीभागवतमिष्यते तद्रसामृततृप्तस्य नान्यत्र स्याद्रतिः क्वचित् सर्ववेदान्त आफ् आल् वेदान्त फिलोसफी सारं दि एसेन्स् हि इण्डीड् श्रीभागवतं श्रीमद्भागवतम् इष्यते इस् सेट् टु बी तत् of it ras amrita by the nectarian taste truptasya for one who is satisfied na not anyatra elsewhere syat there is ratihi attraction kwachit ever. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Translation: Srimad Bhagavatam is declared to be the essence of all Vedanta philosophy. One who has felt satisfaction from its nectarian mellow will never be attracted to any other literature. There is no purport for this verse. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya चक्षुरुन्मिलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नमाम विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी इति नामिने नमस्ते सारस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य देशतारिणे वांछाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिंधुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। Hare Krishna. So today I'll discuss on the topic of what makes the Bhagavatam so special. So often works that are literary composed, the works of literature, they have a revealing cyclicity to them. Cyclicity means that what is spoken in the beginning is again referred to in the end, and it is referred to in the end in a way which brings a sense of satisfying closure. Just like in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a lot of metaphysical discussion which is the heart of the Gita, but the first verse and the last verse have a beautiful cyclicity. The first verse is what happens. Dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yuyutsava mamaka pandavaschaiva kimakurvata sanjaya. While the specific question is what did they do, the underlying question is what happened over there, or what's going to happen, what happened. So that is answered in the form of a prophecy at the end. So yatra yogeshwara krishna yatra partho dhanurdhara tatra shrir vijayo bhutir dhruvani tirma tirmama. So there is a specific and universal aspect to that answer. Specifically, the answer is yes, in Kurukshetra, Krishna and Arjuna, their side will be victorious. But he's also generically saying wherever this combination is there, wherever there's a Lord and the devotee, that is where victory will be there. So in literature that is actually well composed, there is this very satisfying combination of specificity and universality. That the specific details of time, place, they attract attention. If we always talk in abstract principles, then it is not so easy to connect with that. For example, if we say we should be humble, we should be gentle, we should be kind, okay, that's nice to hear. But if we have examples of people who are humble, gentle, kind, the heart connects more with specifics. At the same time, specifics, unless you have draw something universal from them, specifics can remain just entertaining stories. So the sometimes people say that, you know, there's two genres of writing, fiction and non-fiction, and fiction is said to be unreal. But actually, when we talk about writing which is not in the genre of non-fiction, scriptures are not fiction, but every major civilization in the world has had certain books which were centered on certain stories, and those stories have a foundational value in shaping that entire civilization. So for example, when the British came to India and they were trying to convert Indians, so one of the most prominent British missionaries, he said that if you want to understand the Indian mind, says you need to read the Ramayana. So it was like a prescribed reading for all Christian preachers who came to India. They're not interested in becoming devotees of Ram, but they wanted to understand from a sociological perspective how people think, what are the foundational values. So in that sense, the stories that have such foundational value, they are not unreal. Actually, we can say that they are more real than reality. What do you mean more real than reality? That we experience reality, each of us, in a particular way. But throughout history, different people have experienced life in different ways. And some people's lives have been more influential. Some people are wiser than others. So those stories are stories through which many other people can learn.
And now I'm of course talking here not from the perspective of revelation. That's an entirely different perspective, and that's also valuable. But even if somebody is not able to accept the idea of revelation, no, we don't have to evaluate literature, sacred literature, simply based on its factuality or rationality. Hey, this doesn't make sense. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that the fifth canto cosmology description is there primarily to block those from access to the tenth canto pastimes of Krishna who get too caught in literalistic things. Basically, there he talks about Saragrahi and Bharavahi. So he says those who do not understand what is the essence of a book, they will get caught in it. This doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. So the point of the Bhagavatam is to help Parikshit Maharaj remember Krishna. And everything in the Bhagavatam is meant for this purpose. For it's not just remembrance of Krishna, it's actually relishable remembrance of Krishna. It is to give rasa. So there is smriti or smaran, there is remembrance, but there is smriti which is with rasa, with joy, with taste. So it is said over here that on hearing the Bhagavatam, what is going to happen? If we can taste the nectar, the rasa amrita. The word amrita is used quite often in the Vedic literature in terms of the heavenly nectar, the somaras, that the people who have done great sacrifices and attained heavens, they drink. Here it is talking about rasa amrita, the amrita of rasa, which is coming from remembrance of Krishna. If one can taste that, then one will lose all other cravings. Nanyatra syadatihi kochit. And actually, we start thinking about things, we get entangled in things because we are attracted to them. So the Bhagavatam is in this sense implying disentanglement and liberation. By not saying explicitly you'll get liberated, but we're saying that which causes entanglement, our attraction to various worldly things, will become freed from that. So this is the, we could say, a part of the Falashruti of the Bhagavatam. Now, I started by saying how great literature, they have a universality and a cyclicity to them. So cyclicity means, today's class will focus on how this particular promise that rasamrita truptasya nanyatra syadatihi kvachit, that if you taste this, you will not have taste for anything else. That is pointed to in the start of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam can be analyzed in various ways. In one sense, the Bhagavatam itself is like a conceptual autobiography of Shukadev Goswami. So there is a historical autobiography where, say for example, this happened at this time, somebody might write a story, this happened at this time, this happened at this time, this happened at this time. That's a historical autobiography. Whereas conceptual autobiography is a different genre of writing, in that how a person's conceptual understanding evolved, that is described. So the Bhagavatam does not describe many incidents from Shukadeva Goswami's life. But we know that Shukadeva Goswami had a journey from being an impersonalist to becoming an ecstatic devotee. And how somebody with that kind of understanding, with various kinds of understanding, including the impersonal understanding, can move toward the personal understanding of Krishna and relish that. That the Bhagavatam describes. And this journey is pointed out in the first three verses of the Bhagavatam. So, I summarize these three verses in an acronym, ACT. A-C-T. And actually, why ACT? Because the Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta is not the Gaudiya Siddhanta, the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sadhana is actually acting as a way to salvation. We act as if we have devotion, not in the sense of pretending, but in the sense of aspiring. And by acting as if we have devotion, we will cultivate devotion. So ACT. Now the first word, so the ACT, what is this? This is analyze, choose and taste. And the Bhagavatam is a work of profound philosophy. Philosophy has many different branches, and one of the foundational branches is epistemology. Epistemology is knowledge about how we acquire knowledge. Now, how do we know things? So it is a pratyaksha, anuman shabda, this is epistemology. Now, we have already, when somebody is studying Bhagavatam, it's already implied that they have accepted Bhagavatam as a source of epistemology. So when philosophy, what does the word philosophy literally mean? Philī is love and sophos is truth. So philosophy is love of truth. A philosopher is one who is seeking what is real. And if we want to know what is real, there are basically, first is, okay, how do I know? What is the source of knowledge? Once you move from epistemology, then the next is what is called as ontology. Ontology is, okay, what is there to know? How to know is the first step. Then what is there to know? What is the nature of reality? And that, the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam talks about ontology. What is the nature of reality? Satyam Param Dhimahi. I'll explain this verse, but I'll just go over the flow first and then we'll move forward. And then, once we understand what is the nature of reality, then the next question comes, how am I meant to act in relationship with reality? How am I meant to act? What am I meant to do? And that is ethics. Ethics is not just simply moralizing, do this, don't do this. It is actually understanding what is the most productive way of living when I understand the nature of reality. Say for example, if I understand that, say, if we are driving, and if I'm driving in India or I'm driving in America, now we drive on different sides of the road. So once I understand ontology, where am I? Then I will know which is the direction to ride on. If I ride on the other, drive on the other side, I'll get into unnecessary trouble. So ethics naturally grows from ontology. And it is primarily when ethics is taught without an ontology, then ethics starts seeming very restrictive and prohibitive. And that is the biggest problem with religious moralizing in today's world. That people are told that do this, don't do this. But they are not told why you should do this or why you should not do this. And this is just our tradition. This is our culture. That is an utterly unconvincing answer for most people today. So from ontology, when we understand the nature of reality, comes ethics. And from ethics, what comes after that? So, okay, this is the nature of reality. This is how I should act. So, okay, this is the country where you are in. These are the rules of road travel. Then if you travel, you get to a particular destination. So what is the destination to be achieved? What is it that we are to experience? That is a branch of philosophy called aesthetics. Aesthetics means how are we to experience reality? So what is the nature of reality? How am I meant to act? And what will I experience when I act accordingly? That's aesthetics. So the second verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam is about ethics. It dharma projahita kaitavotra. How we should act. And then the third verse of the Bhagavatam is about what will you experience by this. Pibata Bhagavatam rasamalayam. That rasa, the same concept that is talked about in this verse. Rasamrita truptasya. So what the Bhagavatam says, that you will experience rasa or relish the rasa. The Bhagavatam itself gives the experience of that rasa and says at the end that if you experience this rasa, you will not want to seek anything else. So aesthetics is about the experience of rasa. And now this could also be seen in terms of the traditional Gaudiya Vaishnava tripartite analysis of things. Sambandha, Abhideya and Prayojan. So Sambandha is the literal translation of Sambandha is relationship. But Sambandha is basically an awareness of reality. So if we see the way things are analyzed, Sambandha gives us ontological knowledge, the nature of reality. Abhideya is associated with ethics. What are you meant to do? How are we meant to act? And rasa, the third verse, uses taste, that is prayojan. That's aesthetics. So the Bhagavatam's focus, it does do It does do a philosophical analysis based on ontology. It does do an ethical analysis. But its primary purpose is the aesthetic experience of the divine. That is the experience of Krishna. So, let's see how this particular journey is traced in the Bhagavatam. So, the first verse is Satyam Param Dhimahi. That's the end of that verse. Now, Dhimahi, meditation, contemplate, that or analyze, that is quite often the Advaitic or the monistic way of looking at things. Just meditate on the ultimate reality. Now, of course, devotees can also meditate. But more often than not, meditation in terms of, okay, this is the reality and everything else is false. That is often the monistic way of looking at things. But rasa is quintessentially a devotional forte. So the Bhagavatam itself in the first three verses moves from dhimahi to pibat rasamalayam. That muhuraho rasika bhavibhavuka. So from meditate to relish. From analyze to taste. So what I talked about, a conceptual autobiography of Shukadeva Goswami, that from monistic understanding to a devotional understanding. That's what the Bhagavatam itself is doing in its first three verses. And that is what it does throughout its whole journey also. So with this broad understanding, now let's look at some specific points within these three verses and how they are reflected in the Bhagavatam and how they apply in our practice of bhakti also. So the first verse itself is an encyclopedia, and in fact there's an acharya who has written a whole book, Srimad Bhagavatam Prathama Shloka Mahatmya. So entire book just on the first verse of the Bhagavatam. Quite often, if you see many acharyas, when they are writing a book, they give, for example, in his Vedanta Sutra commentary, Sri Bhasya Ramanacharya's commentary on the first verse itself is huge. It runs into dozens and dozens and dozens of pages. Because in that verse, he actually condenses and gives practically what he is giving in the entire book. And if you see, Srila Prabhupada's commentary in the first verse is also fairly large. His commentaries in general are significantly big as compared to previous acharya's commentaries. And his first course commentary is significantly large. So the first verse, we cannot cover it entirely. But let's look at this from this perspective. That the first verse is giving us an ontological understanding of the nature of reality. Now, we may understand, what is there to understand about the nature of reality? Actually, every branch of knowledge, as it advances, it moves in its understanding of reality from appearance to substance. Now, it is, sometimes people say seeing is believing. And they say, if you show me God, you can accept it. Actually, if somebody says seeing is believing, then they would have to give up science. Because all of science operates in moving from visible phenomena to invisible principles that explain those phenomena. Newton saw the fruit falling and he postulated gravity. Now gravity is invisible. So in general, knowledge involves understanding of abstract principles. If our knowledge is too specific, okay, this, okay, that's fine. But our knowledge broadens when we understand abstract principles that underlie specific realities. Say, for example, if we go to a particular part of the world, if we go to Karnataka, then we understand that people over there speak Kannada. So they have their own individuality. But if I am to communicate with them, I have to have that all these people speak Kannada. This is an abstract understanding evolved from my interaction with people over there. And for us to function in the world, if every time I meet a person and I have to think, which language am I supposed to speak in? And I start thinking, do I know this language or do I not know this language? Then we will get cognitively overloaded. So for us to function, we need abstract principles that help us to deal with specific phenomena. In fact, all understanding, all progress of understanding is involving this, is called abstract thinking or abstraction. Abstraction from specifics. So science involves, okay, you see a fruit falling, but you abstract from it. Okay, there's a principle of gravity. So similarly, now different branches of knowledge draw different abstract categories or abstract principles for understanding things. But is there an abstract category that is universal? Is there one universal principle that includes all of reality? And that universal principle is the ultimate reality. That is God. So, janmadi asyata anvaiditatashyarteshu abhigyasvarat. So, now, some people may say, I don't believe in God. But everybody has some abstract principle which they consider to be the underlying unifying principle of all of reality. That means what? So, whatever is anybody's locus of ultimate unreality, that is their God. Say for example, some people may believe that the whole world moves around money. And everybody can be bought if you just give them enough money. Then for such a person, their God is money. For somebody, their understanding might be that if you can just have enough power to scare people, then you can make bend people to your will. So for them, their God is power. So the idea here is that everybody has some understanding of how things work. What is the ultimate understanding in under which all other understandings can be included? So some people may think that it is sensual pleasure. Now anybody is there, if you just tempt them properly, properly means of course improperly, but if you tempt them, they will succumb. So that is the idea that, so for them, sensual pleasure is considered the ultimate reality. So we see that the Bhagavad also talks about this, that those who say asatyam apatishtham te jagadahu ranishwaram aparaspara sambhutam kim anyat kamahaitukam. So okay, you say there is no truth, but there is a truth. What is that? Kamahaitukam. Everything is driven by kama. So everybody has some understanding of what is the ultimate reality. What is that abstract principle that explains all of reality? Now, what the Bhagavatam says is, that is the ultimate principle that I want to meditate on. And very interestingly, what the Bhagavatam further says is, it is this abstract principle that gives reality to all other apparent realities. Janmadhyasyata anvaiditatas charteshu abhigyasvarat tene brahmaradaya adhikavaye muhiyanti yat surayaha. Even the suras become deluded by him. Tejo vari vridam yatha vinimayo yatra trisargo amrisha. So the world that is unreal appears real because of this ultimate reality. So we don't deny the reality of the various things in the world. But we understand that. So is money a great influencer? Yes. Is power a great influencer? Is sensual temptation a great influencer? Yes, all of these are true. But underlying them, all of them get their power from that ultimate reality. Yadyad vibhuti mat sattvam shrimad urjitam evava tatta deva avagachatvam mama tejo amsha sambhava. So the Bhagavatam says that the mood of the Bhagavatam in this verse is that if we understand that everything attractive comes from Krishna, then we can become conscious of Krishna even through the things that make us unconscious of Krishna. I'll repeat this. We can become conscious of Krishna even through the things that make us unconscious of Krishna. What do I mean become unconscious of Krishna? If, say somebody gets caught in wealth, somebody gets caught in power, somebody gets caught in sensual pleasure. Now those are things which make us unconscious of Krishna. But if we look at it from the perspective that this whole world is an arrangement created by Krishna. So for example, if somebody is watching a movie, and now, and they are watching a movie, now some movies are so boring that people just wonder when is this movie going to end. And some people, some movies are so engrossing that people think, hey, it ended. It is so engrossing. So if some movie is so engrossing that we forget everything else, then what does it indicate? That indicates that the movie maker is so good. The director, the actor, they are all so good that this movie is so engrossing. So the world is like that. It is an illusion. But in the very potency of that illusion, we can appreciate the value of the person who has made that illusion. I was in America. I was invited to give a talk at one university. The name of that university is the American Institute of Illusion. So, it is basically an institute for film and movie training. How people become camera, they do direction and all those things. So actually, I was thinking that the way Western culture is spreading all over the world, the whole world is like an American Institute of Illusion now. But the point is that there, if somebody learns, they become expert. So if somebody can create a very expert illusion, that indicates the expertise of the illusion maker. So the Bhagavatam doesn't deny the reality of the world, but helps us to see that this temporary reality is founded in some eternal reality. Satyam Param Dhimahi. So there are many Satyas, but this is the Param Satya. So meditate on that ultimate reality. So analyze. Analyzing is vital for understanding any subject deeply. So what do you mean by analysis? Analysis means we take specific stimuli and we try to understand underlying principles that make those stimuli work. So the Bhagavatam says that ultimate stimuli is Vasudeva, is Krishna. And this is what the Bhagavatam again shows throughout its, say, the Bhagavatam when it analyzes material nature. So this is, it analyzes material nature broadly in three sections. First, the second canto, the Virat Rupa, the third canto, Sankhya, and the fifth canto, cosmology. And in all these three analyses, its purpose is that from the world we move toward God. Now Prabhupada writes in his book On the Way to Krishna that all knowledge comes from Krishna, but all knowledge doesn't begin from Krishna. Mattah smritir jnanam apahancha, that all knowledge comes from Krishna. But when we want to learn, we don't start learning suddenly, we don't think about God, we think about the world around us. So the Bhagavatam takes that same thing. Okay, look at the world around you, and then we see the gigantic manifestations in the world and see that, oh, these are manifestations of the universal form. So by envisioning the universal form, we can move from the universe to the transcendental Lord. Similarly, in the third canto, what is done is the universe is analyzed through Sankhya. It's deconstructed into its various elements. And then after that deconstruction to various elements, then okay, earth, water, fire, air, ether, all these elements. Now if somebody just kept a lump of earth or kept a glass of water, or somebody kept a little, maybe a pot filled with air, a balloon filled with air, and nobody is going to fall in love with that and sing love songs about water, air and earth. But what happens? They come together and we can get captivated by that combination. So that analysis helps us to see the Bhagavat, the Sankhya. There has been what is called as atheistic Sankhya and theistic Sankhya. So atheistic Sankhya just does analysis and it comes to the end. The end is, okay, all the attractive things of this world, their attraction is of the world, their attraction is illusion. But theistic Sankhya goes, okay, yes, the attractiveness of the world is illusion, but what is behind it? There is an omnipotent divine who is the source of that illusion, who is the creator and sustainer of that illusion, and he is supremely attractive. So the Bhagavatam Sankhya in that sense is significantly different from Sankhya as one of the branches of knowledge in the six systems of philosophy. And that's why if you see Baldev Vidyabhushan in his Govinda Bhashya, see, the Vedanta Sutra is basically a refutation of all other systems of thought to proclaim Vedanta as the highest. So in Baldev Vidyabhushan, his Govinda Bhashya commentary elaborately refutes Sankhya. Now when he's refuting Sankhya, he's not refuting the Bhagavatam Sankhya, he's refuting the Ishwar Karika, the Ishwar Krishna Sankhya Karika Sankhya. So, but the Bhagavatam takes this, okay, deconstruct the world, but go beyond the world to the ultimate reality. That's the Bhagavatam we analyze in third canto. The fifth canto has cosmology. Now, the purpose of the cosmology in the Bhagavatam is primarily to help us meditate on the Lord. So, the Bhagavatam is not Shukdev Goswami, sorry, Parikshit Maharaj, when he is just about to die 7 days before, he is not interested in getting a doctorate in cosmology. His purpose is that in every way direct the mind toward the Lord. So the Bhagavatam gives again a description of the cosmos in a way by which the mind can go from the cosmos to the Lord of the cosmos. So this is analyze. Satyam Param Dhimahi. There are various things which look real in this world, but from this temporary reality to the ultimate reality, how do we go? That's the first verse of the Bhagavatam as it is analyzed through the flow of the Bhagavatam. Now the second verse of the Bhagavatam, so I talked about first verses. Does anyone remember that was what? Ontology. Second verse was ethics. Now how do we act in relationship with the world? Thank you. So then the Bhagavatam says, Dharma Projahita Kaitavotra Paramo Nirmatsaranam Satam. That give up all subordinate principles of religion. So the idea is that there are, we could say, multiple levels of reality, and there is a supreme reality. So anything that takes us to anything less than the ultimate reality, that the Bhagavatam considers to be something which has to be given up. So how do we act? Act in a way that keeps, that takes us to the ultimate reality. And many of the narratives in the Bhagavatam are on this platform. Now if we consider, every book is written for a particular audience. So if somebody comes for a Bhagavatam class, and the whole Bhagavatam class is how we should stop eating meat, well, maybe it is a, if it is meant to say equip devotees with resources so that again they tell others, then it makes sense. But otherwise, if somebody is not eating meat at all, then there's no point to tell them don't eat meat, isn't it? So similarly, the Bhagavatam is spoken to already a cultivated, a refined audience. And in that sense, the Bhagavatam doesn't have to talk about so much about a person giving up a dharma to take up dharma. When the Bhagavatam talks about dharma projahita kaitavotra, it is about don't do dharma for material purposes. Don't do dharma for artha kama or even moksha. Dharma is ultimately for paramartha, for bhakti, for attaining Krishna. And most of the defining narratives in the Bhagavatam are centered on that. What are they centered on? Say, for example, if we consider the story of, see, there are many traditional hierarchies. Say, for example, devatas are considered better than the asuras. But the Vritrasura pastime inverts that hierarchy and shows how an asura is better than a devata. And that Indra is shown to be practicing mixed devotional service, and Vritrasura is shown to be practicing pure devotional service. Now, sometimes the seventh canto is seen as say, like the conflict between Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad. And yes, of course, it is there, but some of our acharyas explained that the real purpose of the Bhagavatam's seventh canto narration is to show how Prahlad's devotion is greater than the devotion of all the devatas. And that's why if we consider the seventh canto, the eighth and nine chapters, elaborate verses of prayers given by Prahlad Maharaj. So the idea is, in the sixth canto, it is showed that one demon is better than one devata. One asura is better than one devata. But the Bhagavatam in the seventh canto shows how one person who is born in the asura family is better than all the devatas, the best of the devatas. So normally, so here what is the Bhagavatam doing? The idea of ethics that is there in the Mahabharata, that is there in the broad Vedic culture is, you do dharma, by that you will get artha and kama. So you'll go to heavens. In fact, in the Mahabharata, most of the references are how you will attain heavens. So when the Bhagavatam is speaking to its audience, what is it speaking? It is not talking so much about people who are adharmic. Its focus is, you are practicing dharma, but don't do it for artha and kama. do it for bhakti. So within, if dharma is done for artha and kama, for that there is a certain hierarchy. The asudevatas are those who have done dharma in the past, and that's why they have gone to that high level. The asuras who have failed to do dharma, and that's why they have gone to that low level. But the Bhagavatam says, if you have bhakti, then that hierarchy gets inverted. So the Bhagavatam's ethics center on the primacy of bhakti. The most defining ethical choice is the choice of bhakti. Then if we go further, this just gets inverted more and more. Say, normally the priest or the guru is considered higher than the disciple. But the 8th canto inverts that hierarchy by showing how Bali Maharaj is higher than Shukracharya. The 9th canto takes the same theme and inverts the hierarchy of Varnashram. Normally a Brahmana sannyasi is higher than a Grahastha Kshatriya. But Ambarish Maharaj is shown to be higher than Durvasa Muni. And this hierarchy attains its zenith in the 10th canto, especially with the gopis of Vrindavan. The gopis of Vrindavan, they actually, when they leave their homes to go to the forest, they are giving up that which is considered to be one of the most foundational pillars of dharma, the chastity of a woman. Of course, they never become unchaste, but at least to worldly appearance. So the gopis demonstrate what the Bhagavad Gita says, sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja. So give up all dharma, even the dharma that is most cherished. So the Bhagavatam's ethics center on this, that dharma projaita kaita utra paramo nirmat saranam sata. Give up all dharma, give up all lower dharma, do only that which connects you with Krishna, that which connects one with Krishna. And then, so I think I had mentioned this earlier, that how this concept of giving up dharma is very difficult for people to understand. I was once at a Gita Jayanti, I was invited to talk at a Hindu forum. And there they had children who were doing Gita recitation, and they recited Gita verses. So when they were reciting some selected Gita verses, they recited one verse, 1866. So, and they recited as sarva adharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami ma shuchah. So after that whole in ceremony got over, then I asked the organizers, now this verse is sarva adharman parityajya. He says, why are you reciting as sarva adharman parityajya? So this person quoted some Bhagavad Gita scholar, and he said, actually Krishna has come to establish dharma. Why would he tell anyone to give up dharma? So he says, over the centuries when the Bhagavad Gita was being written, somebody forgot to put the A while writing it. So what somebody left out, we have brought it back again. That's why the sarva adharma anparityajya. But if you see, Arjuna is already a dharmic person. For Arjuna, he is not, adharma is not an option at all for him. In fact, the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is the dilemma that Arjuna is facing. That is the dilemma that the Pandavas themselves discuss about elaborately in the Udyoga Parva of the Mahabharata. And there, Yudhishthira and the Pandavas, they are discussing that we have two dharmas. We have our Kula Dharma and we have our Kshatriya Dharma. The Kula Dharma is that I have to protect the members of my Kula, my dynasty. The Kshatriya is Dharma is that we have to punish aggressors. Now what do we do when the aggressors are members of our own Kula? So for Arjuna it was a Dharma Sambraha. There are two dharmas pulling him in two different directions. And Krishna's answer is that when you are having a confusion like this, not that Sarva Dharman Parityajya means you become adharmic. You give up all those dharmas that's come in the way of doing mam ekam sharanam vraj, of surrendering to me. So Prabhupada says in a lecture that the hippies had already done sarva dharman parityajya. You know, they had given up education, family, even bodily hygiene. Prabhupada said they had done sarva dharman parityajya. I taught them mam ekam sharanam vraj. So the point is that the Bhagavatam, when it says Sarva Dharman Parityajya, it is, the focus is not become adharmic, but give up that dharma that comes in the way of Mamekam Sharanam Praja. And that's why at the end of the Gita, what Arjuna says is Karishye Vachanam Tava. He doesn't say I will fight. He says I will do your will. In that particular context, doing the will meant Arjuna fought, which is Arjuna did his Kshatriya Dharma. But the Gita's message is not that Arjuna do your Kshatriya Dharma. The Gita's message is do your Sanatan Dharma. And doing that Sanatan Dharma in that situation required him to do his Kshatriya Dharma. So the point is the Bhagavata in this sense and the Bhagavatam in that sense, the ethics are that the most valuable ethical choice is that choice which takes us toward Krishna. And we have many, many guidelines for deciding things. And all those guidelines are valuable. But the most important guideline is that what will take us closer to Krishna. And for that purpose, we can give up everything else. So if somebody is even neglecting all other guidelines, but sticking to that guideline, they are glorious. So that is the speciality of the gopis. That which is considered to be one of the most important principles of dharma, especially for a woman, the gopis are ready to give that up for Krishna. Of course, if you see in all these pastimes, the Bhagavatam, although it transcends aparadharma, but it doesn't condemn aparadharma. Although Bali Maharaj is shown to be higher than Shukracharya, but there is no condemnation of Shukracharya. In fact, after the whole incident, Vamandev still treats Bali Maharaj like a venerable, respectable teacher and asks him what was wrong with the sacrifice. So the Bhagavatam does not dismissively reject aparadharma. Although it proclaims paradharma, it does not dismiss aparadharma. Because for many people, aparadharma is the level at which they can practice. And that's why in the gopis pastime also, although at one level it is described pati sutanvaya bhratru bandhavan ati vilangyate antyachyutagataha, that we gave up, all our family members were obstructing us, but we gave them all up to come to you, O Krishna. Although it is said like that, at the end of that the Ras Panchadhyay, what the Bhagavatam says is when the gopis came back, none of their husbands were angry with them. Because the illusory energy, because Yoga Maya created forms of the gopis who remained back. So the husbands thought that actually we succeeded in restraining our wives, or the family members thought that we succeeded in restraining the gopis from going. So the Bhagavatam, it establishes paradharma, but it doesn't trivialize or condemn aparadharma. So that is important. Vishwanatha Chakravarti says that in his Bhagavatam purport that although devotees do not worship the devatas, the devotee shouldn't condemn the worship of the devatas also. Because that is also required for people at a particular level. And so anyway, the point is with respect to ethics, what the dharma projahita kaitavatra. So the Bhagavatam says that this is choose that which will take you close to Krishna. That is the supreme ethical value. The supreme ethical guideline rather. Is that choose that which will take you closer, that action which will take us closer to Krishna. And then last is the Nigam Kalpataror Galitam Phalam. So that is something similar to Sarva Vedanta Saram hi. That the essence of studying all the Vedic literature, the Vedic literature give various kinds of knowledge. Some of that knowledge we can understand now, some of that knowledge we can't understand now. But the important thing is don't get caught in things that are not the purpose of the Bhagavatam. What do I mean that things are not the purpose of the Bhagavatam? That the purpose of the Bhagavatam is to give the experience of rasa. The experience of rasa is that the experience of relishable remembrance of Krishna. And that is the point of the Bhagavatam. Now our acharyas, for example Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, now he wrote on the Bhagavatam, he was also an astronomer before that, he wrote on the Surya Siddhanta also. And the Surya Siddhanta cosmology and the Bhagavatam's cosmology is very different. And although although devotees are trying to bring about some reconciliation, but it's not very easy to do that. And for all practical purposes, even our acharyas, no acharya, while writing the commentary on the Bhagavatam, even on the fifth canto, no acharya has ever used or even tried to use the Bhagavatam's cosmology for doing any astrological calculations. They're two different conceptual tools for two different purposes. So for astrological purposes, the astronomy as given in the Surya Siddhanta is used. The Bhagavatam's cosmology is for rasa. It is for the purpose of remembering Krishna. It is for the purpose of seeing how the whole universe... I did an elaborate analysis. I was a part of the cosmology team at one time. So with Danvir Maharaj I was working. So we did elaborate analysis of the chapters 15 to 25 where the cosmology is described. And actually, with study cosmology is the study of cosmos. Within that there is cosmography. Cosmography is specifically the study of dimensions. What is the size of this particular thing? What is the distance between this and this? So the cosmographical descriptions in those chapters are very few. It's barely less than 1/4 of the verses of the fifth canto, the cosmology section, give any cosmographic descriptions. More what is given over there is, okay, this is this planet, this is this big, and this is how the people in this planet are worshipping the Lord. This is the prayers that they are singing. So the idea is that everybody throughout the universe is focused on dharma and devotion. And therefore, we should also, by meditating on the cosmos, be inspired to focus on dharma and devotion. So, when we see that the purpose of all of the Bhagavatam is to give us experience of rasa, then we can move forward purposefully. I'll conclude with one last point, that one of the most controversial books that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote was a book called Krishna Samhita. Now, in that book, right in the start of this book, he says, you know, there are different, he writes in the, I'm paraphrasing, in the foreword of that book he writes that there are different approaches required for giving understanding to different people. So if whatever I say in this book is disturbing to those who are traditional students of the Bhagavatam, I offer my obeisances to them and tell them that this book is meant for another audience. So what does he do in that book? It's a whole elaborate subject, but I'll just... The point of how rasa has to be stressed. That's the point I'm making over here. He redefines these three categories, Kanishtha, Madhyam and Uttama. And what does he say? Kanishtha are those who stick to literal understanding of things. And many of the scholars at that time, they were focusing on whether they're Indian spiritual teachers or Christian or British colonist teachers. Even on the British who came to India, there was actually conflicts. There were Christians and there were rationalists. But both of them were criticizing Vedic culture. Because the Christians, this is a pagan culture. The rationalists, this is an irrational culture. Both of them were critical. But he said that, so the Madhyam level is okay. There is wisdom in this book, but that wisdom is not in the literal reading. You look at the abstract principles. So he said, those are the Madhyama people. But he says that, yes, there's Madhyama, but and those who look for some abstract principles and try to gain some wisdom from the books without getting caught in literal things. They say literal thing, that is primitive people. But those who look for abstract principles, they are evolved. He says, yes, those who look for universal principles or abstract principles, they are more evolved. But he says there is a Uttama also. And what is the Uttama? Who go beyond looking for abstract principles to looking for the aesthetic experience. He says, the Bhagavatam is meant to give us an experience of the divine. And that is its primary purpose. So what he is doing in that book is, he is patting on the back of people who think that they are very intelligent, or they are more intelligent than the neophytes who take everything literally. It's okay, you may be higher than this, you may be higher than them, but there is something higher than you also. And focus on that. So the idea is, rasa, we need to give everybody, the Bhagavatam is meant to give everyone the experience of rasa. So when we study the Bhagavatam, when we share the Bhagavatam, that if through that, the experience of the sweetness of Krishna comes out, the beauty of the bhakti conception of the divine comes out, then that Bhagavatam can offer something which no other literature in the world can offer. Because such a vivid, personal, personable vision of the divine that is not there in any literature of the world. There was a prominent atheist thinker, Friedrich Nietzsche, he said that, now I would believe in a God if he knew how to dance. Because his idea was that the Judeo-Christian conception of God was like a grim divinity who sits on top of clouds and sends down thunderbolts on the sinful. Of course, that's a caricature, but that was a prominent idea. But the Bhagavatam describes a god whose most celebratory activity is the rasa dance. This is a god who dances. So, if we, the Bhagavatam in that sense can give us something which no other literature in the world can offer. Different literatures can offer many different things. This is not a rejection of the knowledge given in other literature. But the rasa that the Bhagavatam can offer, nothing else can offer. And it is Srila Prabhupada who actually made the Bhagavatam accessible to the whole world by writing his commentaries, and not just by writing his commentaries. Now, Prabhupada could have been satisfied in India. He wrote the first three cantos of the Bhagavatam. And generally, when a person is writing, you know, once they start writing books, they get a momentum. And then you can keep writing books. If a writer goes out of momentum in writing, then again to get back to writing is very difficult. So Prabhupada had finished the first canto in three volumes. He had got a momentum. He had got funds. He had got reviews from big people, the President of India, the Prime Minister of India. And he had said that all libraries in India could have standing books, standing orders for all future volumes of the books also. So Prabhupada could have just stayed in India and written the whole Bhagavatam. But Prabhupada didn't just want to write the Bhagavatam. He wanted to give people the experience of Bhagavatam. He wanted to get people to live what the Bhagavatam is teaching. And that's why, if you see, from 63, 64, 65, he wrote the first three cantos. But then after that, the next canto was published in 68. There's a 3-year gap because although Prabhupada was writing, he had no resources for publishing when he was in the West. So Prabhupada took that break. If Prabhupada had stayed only in India, he would easily have completed all the 12 cantos. But there would not be anyone to read those, not many people to read those 12 cantos. So Prabhupada took that effort, not only to translate the Bhagavatam, but to create a whole movement where devotees would have the facility to relish the Bhagavatam. And that rasa we are all getting by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, the legacy of Srila Prabhupada that is coming, continuing through his book, through his followers, through his movement, and through all this, through his mercy. So I'll summarize what I spoke today. I spoke on the theme of what makes the Bhagavatam special. So here it says that what it makes it special is, it is the Vedanta Saram, it is the essence of all the Vedas. And what is that essence? It will give you a rasa that will make you forget all other rasas, all other attractions. That means it will implicitly give liberation, because what causes bondage is our attraction to other things. Now, I talked about how great works of literature, two things, they have a cyclicity, the start and the end. There is a beautiful cyclicity or symmetry, like the Bhagavad Gita's first verse and the last verse. So similarly, one of the defining Phalashruti verses of the Bhagavatam is this, that it will give a unique rasa. And that's what is the start of the Bhagavatam also, first three verses. So the Bhagavatam, in a sense, the first three verses point to a conceptual autobiography of Shukadeva Goswami. Not a historical autobiography, but how the conceptual understanding evolved from the monistic to the personal understanding. So I talk based on the acronym ACT. A was analyze. The first verse is analysis. Satyam Param Dhimahi. Devotees also analyze, but it is primarily the Dhimahi, the meditation is what impersonalists do. And what is the nature of analysis? See, basically, our understanding progresses when we analyze specific phenomena and we come up with universal principles or abstract principles that explain those phenomena. And that abstract principle that explains more and more phenomena, that becomes a bigger and bigger truth. So that abstract principle which explains all of reality, that is the ultimate reality. And that is God. Now different people may have different conceptions of what explains everything. So it may be money, it may be sensual pleasure, it may be power. So all these get their reality from Krishna. So we can become conscious of Krishna even through the things that make us unconscious of Krishna. So the first verse of the Bhagavatam is about ontology, the nature of reality. So analyze to understand that. The second verse of the Bhagavatam is about ethics. That is, choose. You know, choose how you act. So what is the choice? Don't choose aparadharma, choose paradharma. So the analysis of how we can move toward the ultimate reality from this world is done in the second canto through the Virat Rupa, third canto through the Sankhya, and the fifth canto through the cosmology. Then the choose is with respect to ethics. That the paramount guiding principle, ethical guideline the Bhagavatam gives is to make that choice which takes you toward the ultimate reality, Krishna. There can be many different guidelines, and the Bhagavatam in a sense, inverts the traditional hierarchies based on how closely people adhere to the traditional guidelines. So normally the devatas are higher than the asuras, but if a devata is not as devoted as the asura is greater than the devata. That's the sixth canto Vritrasura story, the seventh canto Prahlad story. And then similarly, hierarchies are inverted in the 8th canto, 9th canto through various stories. And the most dramatic inversion of hierarchies is in the story of the gopis, where the gopis give up dharma for the sake of the paradharma. They give up, apparently give up their chastity for surrendering to Krishna. While the Bhagavatam enshrines or enthrones paradharma, it does not trivialize or condemn a paradharma, because that may be also required for people at a particular level. So that's ethics, dharma projahita kaita votra. And the last is taste. So that is pibata bhagavatam rasamalayam. So the whole purpose of the Bhagavatam is to give us the aesthetic experience of Krishna. So there is ontology, there is ethics, and then there is aesthetics. So the experience of Krishna is what the Bhagavatam gives through its various narratives, and especially through the 10th canto pastimes of Krishna. And our acharyas have analyzed the Bhagavatam in such a way that people can get to the aesthetics. So one of the most radical efforts to get people to appreciate the aesthetics of the Bhagavatam is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. He says that, okay, if you consider literal understanding to be low and you consider more non-literal reading to be higher, okay, but beyond your non-literal reading is the aesthetic aspect. So get there. That is his point. And Srila Prabhupada also, he didn't just translate the books, which is a Herculean effort in itself, but he created a movement where we could get the atmosphere by which we could experience the Bhagavatam and relish the rasa that the Bhagavatam offered to Parikshit Maharaj, and through the tradition we all can get. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Any comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you very much, Prabhu, for the wonderful class. I just wanted to know, does Bhagavatam actually invert the hierarchy, or it makes that traditional hierarchy sort of irrelevant in that particular context? Because it's not inverted all the time.
Okay, yeah. Does it invert or does it make it irrelevant? Well, there are different ways of looking at it. First is the point that every society requires some functioning hierarchy to be able to function. And in that sense, there are hierarchies of based on Varanashram and other things in the Bhagavatam. But it shows that if this hierarchy becomes fossilized, becomes rigid, ossified, then it can become unhealthy. And one way that hierarchy can become fossilized is if people at the top start claiming privilege. No, we are in the top and that's why we are powerful. No, they should have the particular competence, they should have the particular abilities or whatever is there that places in the top of the hierarchy. So it shows that this hierarchy is not an absolute hierarchy. That so inverted in the sense that it's not that the hierarchy itself is rejected, but in that context it is shown that those who are at the bottom of the hierarchy, they are actually shown as higher than those who are at a higher level in the hierarchy. Now, in the West, quite often, one of the prominent caricatures of India is that it's a casteist country. It's a discriminatory caste system is there. Now, of course, caste discrimination is bad, as it is. But, say for example, many people convert to other religions, or people canvas conversion to other religions saying because of the caste system, you don't have any, this is a discriminatory system. But actually, long before any such conversion efforts came, you know, there was an inner, we could say, internal reform within the Vedic tradition, and that came from the Bhakti tradition. All the great Bhakti saints, where many of them were from the lower caste, but they were shown to be far higher. So the point I'm making is that sometimes wherever hierarchies can become fossilized, that there is a parameter beyond these hierarchies, which can make those hierarchies either irrelevant, as you said, or the specific positions of the people, it can also become inverted. And those are seen as celebratory occasions. So when Advaita Acharya offers the first food to Haridas Thakur, it might have invoked astonishment or scandal among those who were very stuck to the conservative conceptions of hierarchy. But for him, he said, this is my fortune to be able to do this. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, I'll come to you. Yeah. So maybe you can ask, then the mic goes there. Yeah. You can just ask, I'll repeat. Yeah. Okay, yeah, sure.
Thank you so much, Prabhuji. It was indeed very enlightening class. I had a question that when we talk about rasa, rasa is not an upward approach in the sense, it's not that the sadhak will make an effort and get the rasa. It is more of the downward approach where we say that the mercy of the Lord comes in the form of rasa. So how do we understand it? So, you know, transcending from the level of the universal and abstract principles to the next level of aesthetics, that evolution is more of mercy rather than the effort of sadhaka. So how do we understand it?
Okay. That rasa is more of a descending grace rather than a ascending effort. So how do we get it through sadhana then? Quite often, you know, we operate in the this or that paradigm, whereas reality is often more in the and, this and that. So if you consider the Bhagavatam itself, what it says is that Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. And Prabhupada in the purport writes that even by the mechanical activity of chanting and hearing, one becomes cleansed. Not entirely cleansed, but one becomes prayeshu, significantly cleansed. So we could say that taste ultimately comes by the descending grace of Krishna. But at the same time, if we make the effort to put ourselves in the atmosphere, in the situations where grace can come, that could mean in the association of devotees, that could mean association of devotees can mean various ways. We come for satsang programs, we do some services with devotees. So if we do have the free will or the capacity to place ourselves in situations where we can get the grace, and rather than even thinking of grace as 1-0, even the opportunity to be in those situations is also grace. And if we can't be in those situations, even then, if we have the longing to be in those situations, that longing is also grace. Sometimes we may not be able to do a particular service, but if we long to do that service, then that longing may purify us more than actually doing the service and becoming proud of doing that service. So grace is not like a 1-0 thing. Grace can also come in various installments. And even the opportunity to practice bhakti is also one level of grace. So rasa is in that sense multi-level. And yes, the ultimate rasa by which we lose all taste for material things, that may take time to come, and that will come by Krishna's will. And that requires humility for us, that, you know, it's not a mechanical process by which I can get it. But it's not that till that time we are completely starving. Bhakti has many engagements, and they all, not all of them are equally fulfilling, but they all give certain level of fulfillment. So we need to, in that sense, take individual responsibility to nourish ourselves in the practice of bhakti. So we do the prescribed sadhana, the prescribed seva, whatever it is. But while doing that, we also observe which are the activities that give us strength. And then we do that more. And so that we are exposing ourselves to those channels by which that grace is coming. It's not that we neglect our services, but it may not be that our services consume 24 hours of a day. Say, if we want to hear, we may have different devotees from whom we can hear. But if we find that from a particular devotee, when we hear, it just illuminates us, it connects, we connect with it nicely, then we can choose to hear more from that devotee. So sajatiya, as it is said, that we need to associate like-minded devotees. So why like-minded? Because there are anyway enough conflicts in this world. So even in our understanding of bhakti, if too many conflicts come up, then we will have what you can call as a conflict overload. We can also manage a certain level of conflicts, not too many. That's why like-minded devotee association is there. Then at least within the devotional realm, we are not encountering constant conflicts. Some conflicts are unavoidable in the world. Even some will be there even in the devotee community also. But broadly, like-minded, if we practice bhakti in like-minded association, then the conflicts are lesser and the taste comes easier. So it is our responsibility to find, to observe and note what is it that nourishes us. And in that sense, where do we get rasa at our level? And then cherish that more. And if we start valuing and cherishing what Krishna gives us now, then Krishna will give us more in future. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Okay, one last question. Yeah.
Prabhuji, what is a dharma and what is a paradharma and paradharma?
Okay. So, what is paradharma and aparadharma? So, paradharma is that which takes us to the param satya. That is Krishna. So dharma has many different meanings, but let's translate at this point as duty. So paradharma is that duty, that choice which takes us toward Krishna. Aparadharma, so apara is that which is not transcendental, like we have apara prakriti and para prakriti. So aparadharma is broadly, we could say, that duty which keeps us in harmony with apara reality, apara tattva, with material reality. So dharma, artha, kama, this also works. That means if one lives virtuously, say even in ordinary life, say if you consider dharma as say discipline, self-control, focus, if somebody does that, their chances of becoming successful in that particular area, they're gaining artha, prosperity, they're gaining kama, they get more. So dharma, artha, kama has a particular meaning within the karmakanda section. But generically, dharma, artha, kama, these are principles of how to live in harmony with material reality. How to live so that we are not too disharmonious. And that's why we are the Bhagavatam talking about vidyamcha avidyamcha yastadvedo bhayamsa. That we need to have knowledge of the material world, which is avidya. In that verse, it is called as avidya. And knowledge of the spiritual world, that is vidya. So we need both. So it's not that a devotee just casually or whimsically rejects aparavidya. So for example, there are principles of Ayurveda, of how we should eat, or basically principles of medicine, and there are various other things like that. It's not that devotee arbitrarily rejects them, but if they come in the way of the practice of bhakti, then a devotee subordinates aparadharma to paradharma. So wherever possible, apara and para, both can go together. And that's how we normally try to function. Okay? So, thank you very much. Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhaktavinda ki, Tai Gaur Premanande.